From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. Terry Gross is on vacation. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. On this edition of Fresh Air, the varied life of Norman Rush. He was a conscientious objector during the Korean War, bought and sold rare books, and for 5 years ran the Peace Corps in Botswana. That last job gave him plenty of material for his new novel about Africa, Mating. Also today, Michael Jacobson of the Center for Science in the Public Interest tells us what fast foods are least likely to kill you with fat and sodium. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the soundtrack of the new movie, Naked Lunch. And television critic David Bianculli rates a show about the business of TV ratings. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. New Hampshire voters have been going to the polls all day long in their first-in-the-nation primary. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
So far, nothing about the New Hampshire primary has conformed to expectations. President Bush has faced a tougher-than-expected challenge from conservative television commentator Patrick Buchanan. And today, the president's spokesman tried to ratchet down expectations another notch. They suggest a victory for the president, regardless of its size, is all that matters. And the Democrats were also adjusting expectations. Paul Tsongas has been leading the polls. He surged ahead after the early front-runner Bill Clinton stumbled. Now Clinton's advisors say they never expected to do better than second place, and they predicted that they'd go on to make a good showing in the South, Clinton's base. The upcoming March 3rd Georgia primary will be a good test for both Clinton and Tsongas. Tsongas will find out how well his message plays outside of hard-hit New England. And Clinton will find out how badly the allegations that he dodged the draft hurt him in the South, where military service is held in high regard. In Manchester, I'm Mara Liasson.
A meeting to draft a worldwide treaty on global warming began today at the United Nations, with the Bush administration set to resist specific timetables for controlling damaging emissions. The U.S. stand on global warming is that there's no consensus on the problem among scientists and that each nation should be free to take whatever steps it considers necessary. The European Community, Japan, and many other nations favor specific targets for reducing the emissions that cause global warming. The Bush administration also argues that measures to control carbon dioxide emissions from the burning of fossil fuels would be too expensive and might be impossible to put into effect. The White House said today that Russian President Boris Yeltsin will travel to Washington in July for a summit meeting with President Bush. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater confirmed earlier reports of a midsummer summit between Yeltsin and President Bush, but he had few other details to offer. No specific dates have been set, and Fitzwater said, "There's no particular objective we can define." In Moscow yesterday, Yeltsin said he hoped to discuss further reductions in long-range nuclear weapons arsenals, but domestic politics could determine when the summit takes place. July is also the month of the Democratic Party convention, and a summit could give the president a publicity boost before the Republican convention in August. Mr. Bush and Yeltsin met briefly at Camp David last month and agreed to hold two summits this year. The president plans to travel to Moscow later this year. I'm Richard Gonzalez at the White House.
The National Television Network's joint exit polling projects former Massachusetts Senator Paul Tsongas, the winner of the New Hampshire Democratic presidential primary. President Bush outlasted an exceptional showing by challenger Patrick Buchanan and is projected to win the Republican primary, but Buchanan may earn more than 40% of the vote. This is NPR. Two members of Japan's ruling political party have been linked to a growing bribery scandal. Some observers say that the Sagawa Trucking Company scandal may be the biggest in Japan's post-war history, eclipsing even the recruit scandal of 3 years ago. The recruit scandal, in which politicians were given stock in return for favors, forced the resignation of then-Prime Minister Kiichi Miyazawa, or then-Finance Minister Kiichi Miyazawa. Miyazawa returned to power last year as Japan's prime minister. Japanese media reports estimated that as many as 130 members of parliament, including the top members of Miyazawa's party, may have taken money from a political slush fund set up by the trucking company. Defense Secretary Dick Cheney has arrived in Panama on the second leg of an extended trip through Latin America. David Adams reports from Panama City.
Defense Secretary Cheney went straight to a working lunch with General George Jowen, commander of U.S. forces in Latin America. Later, he traveled into Panama City for a meeting with Panama's president, Guillermo Endara. The top item on Cheney's agenda is officially Panama's cooperation in the war on drugs. But Panamanian and U.S. military sources say the future U.S. military presence in Panama will also be raised. Cheney is expected to tell the Panamanian government that the U.S. intends to stick to plans to withdraw 10,000 troops stationed in Panama. Under the Panama Canal Treaty, U.S. bases must be closed by the year 2000. Military sources say 50% of U.S. troops will be out of Panama by 1996. That's a message many Panamanians find hard to believe. It's a popular perception here that the U.S. wants to keep military bases in Panama. For National Public Radio, this is David Adams in Panama City.
The U.S. team moved into the semifinals of the Olympic hockey tournament today with a 4-1 victory over France. The Americans, still unbeaten, will go on to face the winner of the quarterfinal match between the unified team and Finland. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscowane. In the late 70s, Norman Rush and his wife were co-directors of the Peace Corps program in Botswana in southern Africa. When he returned to the States in 1983, Rush began to write stories about the American presence in Africa. First came his book of stories, Whites. His latest book, a novel called Mating, just won the National Book Award for Fiction. Mating is a comedy of manners about courtship and utopian fantasies. The story revolves around two characters, a young female anthropologist and an older male scientist. The scientist has created a haven for destitute African women in the middle of the Kalahari Desert. Rush has written the story in the woman's voice. I asked him to read from the opening page of his book.
In Africa, you want more, I think. People get avid. This takes different forms in different people, but it shows up in some form in everybody who stays there any length of time. It can be sudden. I include myself. Obviously, I mean whites in Africa and not black Africans. The average black African has the opposite problem. He or she doesn't want enough. A whole profession called rural animation exists, devoted to making villagers want more and work harder to get it. Africans are pretty ungreedy. Elites accepted, naturally. Elites are elites. But in Africa, you see middle-class white people you know for a fact are highly normal turn overnight into chain smokers or heavy drinkers or gourmets. Suddenly you find otherwise serious people wedged in among the maids of the truly rich in the throng at the Chinese butchery, their faces clenched, determined to come away with one of the 9 or 10 half pints of creme fraiche that arrive from Mafeking on Wednesdays at 3. You see people fixate on eating wonderfully despite the derisory palette Botswana offers. Or they may get into quantity sex. Or you can see it strike them that there's no reason they shouldn't take a stab at getting rich before they have to leave Africa. Most expatriates can only stay for a few years, and like clockwork, when they get toward the end, they start buying up carosses or carvings to resell, or they decide to buy real estate through Botswana proxies, or in one case, to found the first peewee golf course south of the Sahara. I knew someone who was an ect mama's boy in real life who took insane risks smuggling wristwatches into Zimbabwe on weekends. He was at the very end of his contract. He was teaching law at the University of Botswana.
You were a member of the Foreign Service, and you and your wife actually directed the Peace Corps program in Botswana.
That's right. Yes, we did.
What took you to Botswana?
Well, two things, I think, together. One was a desire for adventure and the opportunity to look into strata of life that would otherwise forever be closed to us. And the other was a chance to do a little good. Maybe, if we were lucky. So it was an irresistible combination.
This is Botswana of the late 70s and early 80s.
Right, 78 to 83.
What was the political, cultural climate there at the time?
Well, for us, it was, I guess you could say, you could describe Botswana as being an island of tranquility surrounded by conflict, armed struggle, everywhere you looked. In Namibia, there was the SWAPO rebellion was going on. Zimbabwe, the guerrilla war was coming to an end there. In South Africa, apartheid was in crisis, of course. And in those days, Botswana was the first port of call for people leaving, refugees and exiles. And the South Africans had not yet electrified the border fence along the Limpopo, so people were wading across and coming in that way. And
was it geography then that made Botswana this kind of haven?
Yeah, Botswana became this kind of tranquil place because it was in everybody's interest for it to be that way. And all of the major powers had some sort of representation there because everyone had a stake in how it came out in South Africa. And, of course, the South Africans had their own special branch people undercover in Botswana. So it was a climate that was intensely alive politically, and you were never quite sure who was who in that situation.
What kind of programs did the Peace Corps have there? What kinds of things were they trying to promote?
We supplied teachers for secondary schools, drought relief workers, borehole mechanics, that is people who were training local people to run diesel pumps, tuberculosis control, a broad range, small business development, agriculture. It was a broadly based program of about 120 volunteers, 100 to 120 volunteers over the time span we were there.
I'm curious about the outsiders, even the white people that came to Botswana. You described being there, you wanted to do some good, and you were looking, I guess, for something else. Would you say that characterized other people as well?
Well, it's different for different categories of people. I think that I'm rather hard on the Brits in this book, and I think that a lot of the Brits who were there for a different reason. They were there because they had it pretty good further up in Africa, and as decolonization had rolled them down further and further south, they'd gotten more and more disgruntled, and yet they were not prepared to go back to cloudy England ever. Americans coming into that part of the world come in with a feeling of very clean hands, I think mistakenly, but since they were never original colonizers, they feel that they come in as an ex-colonial, as a representation of ex-colonial intelligence and intentions, and they're not seen that way, of course. So it makes for a very interesting mixture of political attitudes.
Did you have? I'm wondering, even at the sort of end of your term in the Foreign Service or with the Peace Corps, could you have stayed on if you wanted to?
Well, Peace Corps has a rule, which is called the 5-year rule. Then that's you're out after that. Because the notion was that they did not want to create a permanent bureaucracy, revolving. So they want new blood.
Were you ready to go?
We were very tired. Yeah, at the end of 5 years, it's a grueling job. And in fact, I didn't get any writing done while I was in Africa. It was all in the future. I took notes. I brought back tapes and maps and notes of all kinds of things. But there was never any time. It's a 24-hour-a-day job being a Peace Corps director.
And were you even doing any kind of mental writing?
Oh, sure. Yeah, sure. There's no way that I found it so literarily stimulating that there was no way that I wasn't starting stories in my head the whole time. And when I did sit down, when I got back to the United States, everything came very rapidly to me. So clearly some kind of unconscious process of composition had been underway.
I think people that have never been to Africa or certainly the various and variety of countries in Africa don't understand what a rich environment that is. I think, we read, of course, about the terrible famines, the starvations, the civil wars, which are all very real.
Yeah.
But there's this other part of it, and perhaps even only well-off people get a chance to participate in that.
Yeah.
Can you tell us what that is?
Well, it's the variety of life in Africa is in a way misrepresents what you find in Botswana, because life is concentrated very much in the southern and eastern part of the country. It's a big country. It's huge. It's as big as France or Texas. When we were there, it had a population of about 1 million, and that population was mostly concentrated in the strip along the border with South Africa leading up toward Zimbabwe. Where the railway was, the railway line was. But in the north is a very exotic and different kind of society and kind of country. There's a beheaded river up there which produces an inland delta called the Okavango Swamp, which is the last great unfenced game area in the world. And in the desert you have Basarwa, Bushmen, living. The last hunter-gatherers, not very many of them actually hunting and gathering anymore, if you read my book, but bands of them in the Kalahari. And spread out across the country, isolated settlements of people evolving and becoming and surviving in their own way, utterly in their own way. So it appears to be a blank, but uh-huh. But it's not.
Well, how does that get under your skin?
Well, it gets under your skin because you want to understand it. You want to understand how people can live, for example, how people can live with equanimity in the midst of what looks like total desolation, have normal lives, clusters of families in the midst of an absolute desolation, little path leading off to ultimately to a trek route. You would think that this would lead to a sort of impoverished life, but when you get to know these people, you discover enormous qualities and interest in life and everything that makes another human being interesting.
Does that solve a kind of riddle then that you have about human nature?
No, it only adds to it. Right. I think I'm not closer to solving the mystery of the world, as my narrator calls it. But let me just also say, there's another thing about Africa is an astonishing place, and you see things that you're not prepared for all the time. This is kind of a trivial example, but it illustrates the kind of aesthetics shocks that you receive. We were passing through a segment of the Kalahari Desert and came over a rise, and there on the ground in front of us across the roadway were indescribable objects, indescribably beautiful and enigmatic, not identifiable. And it took us a while to figure out what they were. It was late afternoon. The sun was shining in a sort of golden way on these things. And we stopped and discovered that what we were looking at were clods of elephant dung, spherical, quite large. A herd had obviously passed that way. And each clod of dung had been colonized by a different species of butterfly. So these things looked like surreal Christmas tree ornaments distributed across the road, waving, the wings waving, and the colors iridescent and magical. But from 20 feet away, you could not understand what you were seeing.
Norman Rush is my guest today. And from 1978 until the early 80s, for 5 years, he and his wife ran the Peace Corps program in Botswana. They were members of the Foreign Service. He's written 2 books. His first one is called Whites, and his latest one is called Mating. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. Writer Norman Rush is my guest. You spent some time, in fact, many years, as a rare books dealer.
Right, that was, yeah.
And was it, was there something about being surrounded, and I guess I have this image of this, you know, mountain of rare books, and somehow you and
the center very of it. That's very close to the unfortunate truth, and I still haven't cleared the decks. I had my wife I've made promises to her about this, and I'm still clinging to my stock.
I see perhaps these two streams of influences, and I guess I think of these old books and the kind of rich language and mm-hmm. perhaps old stories, and then I think of perhaps even the correspondence that you had to do in the Peace Corps, which I imagine is, you know, very terse kind of writing, and I see kind of evidences of both those in Mating.
Well, yes, you probably do, and also some of the miscellaneous saning up of odd facts. Turned my characters, I've shared that trait with at least one of the characters. That's true. The interest in words also is something that I think people have remarked on the vocabulary of the narrator. And been kind of made much of it. I don't really think that it's that extraordinary for somebody who is coming upward from the underclass to seize on language and a command of language as a way of demonstrating power in the world. And I've known people like this in academic and sub-academic circles. So she's not a willful invention. Mm-hmm. But I confess also to an interest in words, and I think that it's fun to think about how this medium that we use to connect to one another, and how imperfect and how comical it is at times.
Does that mean, as a writer, you go over and over and over to, because the importance of the words to you, that it takes a long time to get them right?
Yeah, I have a perfectionist tendency. I have to say. Although I do not as many drafts as other writers do, but I do a lot of thinking before I write. And it's one reason that I haven't been attracted to the word processor, because so much of what goes on is sort of pre-sorted before I get it down.
Well, how would a word processor inhibit that?
Well, I think people tend to write a great deal, then look at it, and then change it. And I tend to internally do what happens on the screen and then get it down. And I've never adapted to the idea of, I don't think that print appearing on a screen is the same thing. Typing is almost like publishing, for me, in a certain way. So I'm staying with my primitive typewriter, for the time being anyway.
Does that mean non-electric or electric?
No, non-electric. it's a genuine antique, and I'm so wedded to the typeface. It's an elite face that doesn't exist anymore in the world. So I don't know. I think maybe... I'll be in trouble when this thing goes.
Norman Rush is my guest, and his latest book, it's a novel, is called Mating. You were a conscientious objector. This is going back many years. Conscientious objector.
It's going way back, yeah.
During the Korean War.
Right.
And actually went to prison.
Yes.
Would you say this kind of activism, I assume, and this kind of opinionated feelings about politics, has that really continued then through your life?
I have to say yes. I'm still opinionated. I'm still a pacifist. I went to prison because there was no accommodation in the law for someone who was opposed to war and who was not religious. I was objected on moral grounds, but not religious grounds, to war and to killing. And there are echoes of that, of course, in the book throughout. And I haven't changed my views, at least on those issues, and over time.
How did you spend your time in prison?
I worked in the boiler room mostly at night, which was where we burned logs to generate electricity and steam and heat for the prison camp. This was in Tucson, Arizona, minimum security prison in the Catalina Rincon Mountains. I was there for 9 months of a 2-year sentence. I was paroled directly to, almost directly to Swarthmore College, where I proceeded to fall in love with the daughter of the special agent in charge of the FBI in New York City. And if you want to talk about unlikely matings, that the prospects were certainly odd for that one.
Did you feel angry that you had to serve time in prison, or did you feel that that was the price of your beliefs?
No, that was par for the course. And I felt the usual things that a young man feels, all of the questions as to whether cowardice was involved in what I was doing, some unconscious level. So the tiny ordeal that I went through was something I was completely prepared to accept. And actually, it was a fascinating experience, too, although I haven't written about it, but it was.
Fascinating as you look back on
it? Yeah, looking back on it, the people that I met there and the things it did to my way of looking at the world.
Can you be more descriptive?
Well, once you've been in jail, you look at the world differently. You see that you taste what the real sanction is in the making of society, and changes your sympathies, I think, in some profound way. Also, in those days, I was still you still remained subject to selective service. I was until I was about 25 or 26, was still subject to being recalled and having to go through the whole process again. So it gave me a kind of a fugitive outlook on things while this was going, and nourished the oppositional side of my my perceptions, I think.
Did you come from a pacifist family?
Yes. My father ultimately became a pacifist, although he became many other things, too. He started out as a socialist and as an organizer for the Socialist Party in California and a union organizer. When I was born, he received instructions from my mother that all this had to stop and he had to get a job that would pay something. And he became the opposite of what he had been. He became a salesman and a trainer of salesmen. And his intellectual trajectory ultimately took him to Rosicrucianism and theosophy.
Huh.
But in at one small segment in there, he was a pacifist, and it was there that I got my first introduction to pacifist ideas.
And did he support, then, you're going to jail?
Oh, yes, yeah, he understood that. There was never any question about that.
The dedication, or at least the very beginning of your book, is a very powerful and emotional... it's very powerful and emotional. I was wondering if you could read it for us.
Sure. Everything I write is for Elsa, but especially this book, since in it her heart, sensibility, and intellect are so signally, if perforce esoterically, celebrated and exploited. My debt to her in art and in life grows however much I put against it. I also dedicate mating to my beloved son and daughter-in-law, Jason and Monica, to my mother and to the memory of my father and to my lost child, Liza. And to explain the last, I have a daughter who's now 30, who was born with diffuse brain atrophy and has been institutionalized for many years. But I think the rest is pretty self-explanatory.
What is her condition?
She is profoundly retarded and will be so.
So you feel she's lost to you?
Yes, there is no recognition possible between her and us.
Well, what really struck me about that very beginning was just this sense of family that I got. Mm-hmm. I mean, family in the sort of the deepest sense of the word.
Uh-huh. Well, yes, and it's kind of an achievement too. We went through probably the most ferocious adolescence with our son that any family ever survived, and it's now turned out it's all in the past and everything is wonderful, but it was a severe test. He is a mathematician at the University of Washington in Seattle, and he chose mathematics specifically as something that neither one of us had anything to do with. No politics, no art. My wife is a weaver and a textile designer. No politics, no art. So this was his choice. We have a terrific family relationship now.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us today.
It was my great pleasure.
Norman Rush is the author of Mating, which won the National Book Award for Fiction. I'm Marty Moscowain, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
from Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane with Fresh Air. Looking for a quick bite to eat? Michael Jacobson of the Center for Science and the Public Interest says you may want to pass up the Double Western Bacon Cheeseburger, unless you like the idea of eating 16 teaspoons of fat. Coming up, Jacobson tells us what fast foods you should avoid and which ones are actually good for you. TV critic David Bianculli reviews Can You Believe TV Ratings, this week's episode of the public TV science program Nova. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the soundtrack from Naked Lunch, featuring Ornette Coleman. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. According to network exit polls, challenger Patrick Buchanan is running a stronger race than expected in New Hampshire's primary. All of the networks are projecting that Buchanan may earn more than 40% of the vote in the GOP primary in the Granite State. The networks are also projecting former Massachusetts Senator Paul Tsongas winning the New Hampshire Democratic presidential primary, with Arkansas Governor Bill Clinton close behind in the number two spot. Earlier today, Tsongas considered himself the front runner on the Democratic side, although he described himself as a most unlikely candidate. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports from Manchester.
The former senator from Massachusetts has never lost an election from his days on the city council through his years in Congress. Tsongas has campaigned here in New Hampshire for the last 10 months. His home in Lowell is just across the border, and other candidates say his support is primarily regional. Tsongas, however, says it's his message of economic truth that's caught on in this state, which has been hit hard by the recession. If Tsongas does as well as is expected here, the focus will be on whether he can keep the momentum going in other states. He has already made inroads in Maine, where caucuses will be held next Sunday, but the real test will be in states beyond New England. I'm Elizabeth Arnold in Manchester.
A Food and Drug Administration advisory panel has opened 3 days of meetings on silicone gel breast implants. Today, the group heard presentations concerning the likelihood that implants will break and what potential risk broken implants pose. NPR's Michael Scholer is attending the meetings in Bethesda, Maryland.
FDA scientists are running the panel through a review of new information on implant safety. They began by discussing the Dow Corning documents released last week. FDA staff say those documents raise concern about the strength and quality of older model Dow Corning implants, and they claim recent government inspections of implant factories run by four manufacturers show continuing quality control problems. The panel also heard results of new research that found about 5% of women studied had broken implants and did not realize it. The advisors will decide Thursday whether to recommend banning or restricting the gel breast implants. The FDA expects to make a final decision within 2 months. This is Michael Scholer reporting.
At high-level talks in Moscow, Russia and the United States have agreed to set up an early warning center to warn of possible ballistic missile attacks. This is seen as a first step toward a joint defense system. Secretary of State Baker and the Russian foreign minister also agreed to high-level talks with the aim of sharply cutting long-range nuclear stockpiles. Officials hope that agreement can be reached by July. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down over 21 points to close at 3,224.73 in very heavy trading. This is NPR News. U.S. and Russian officials are trading charges over a submarine collision in the Arctic last week. A U.S. official has denied Russian accusations that the American sub was operating secretly in Russian waters. The collision involving a submarine from the former Soviet Union occurred last week, but Defense Department officials said that they withheld information until Secretary of State Baker could discuss it with Russian President Boris Yeltsin in Moscow this week. No injuries have been reported, but the Pentagon says the Commonwealth submarine was damaged. As Israeli troops and Lebanese guerrillas exchanged rocket fire today, U.S. officials said that they still expected the next round of Arab-Israeli talks to start Monday in Washington. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports.
Syria, Jordan, Lebanon, and Israel say they will attend the fourth round of talks next week. And a PLO spokesman announced today that the Palestinian delegation will also participate. but Palestinian negotiators in the West Bank have delayed their departure for the talks. They are protesting Israel's arrest of two members of their delegation. State Department spokesman Richard Boucher today criticized Israel for detaining the men without charges or trial.
As you know, the United States has long opposed the practice of administrative detention as it pertains to the treatment of inhabitants of the occupied territories. We've raised this issue with the Israeli government, particularly the administrative detention of Mohammed Hourani and Jamal al-Shubaki.
Boucher also said he did not see any link between rising violence in Lebanon and the peace process. I'm Linda Gradstein in Washington.
Russia and Cuba have reportedly signed a new agreement involving oil and sugar. According to various news reports, Russia will send oil to Cuba over the next 4 months in return for larger amounts of sugar sent by Cuba to Russia. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
At something near, though not dear, to TV critic David Bianculli's heart, the inner workings of the Nielsen rating system. Here's his review.
This episode of Nova is called Can You Believe TV Ratings? What I can't believe is that Nova, one of my favorite series, took a subject this interesting, at least to me, and turned it into something so boring and misguided. The show does a good job explaining the scientific and statistical stuff behind the national TV ratings. You know, how they're gathered by little computers called people meters, and how a sample of a mere 4,000 households can represent 93 million TV households with any degree of accuracy. But that's the easy stuff. Where it messes up is by not paying attention to either the cause or effect of TV ratings. This Nova falls into the same trap as many TV programmers. It spends way too much time looking at the numbers and too little time looking at the programs. For example, the case study Nova uses is an ABC sitcom called Good and Evil. The show premiered last fall and was canceled shortly thereafter. It was the one where Terry Garr played a rich bitch and Mark Blankfield played a very clumsy blind man. Before Good and Evil premiered, Nova talked to the show's creator, its director, and its executive producers, all of whom went on and on about how daring and different the show was. Then, when it sank like a stone, Nova drew the moral that the rating system, which seems to favor familiarity over innovation, killed it. Here's the Nova narrator, Tony Khan, making their case.
Good and Evil was a brave attempt to be a little different that died because of poor ratings. It may also have been a terrible show, but there's always a chance that it had a solid audience out there. Only they forgot to press the buttons on their people meters.
Now hold it right there. Good and Evil brave? How? By insulting blind people? By having a fire sale on unfunny sexual innuendo? On Nova, the question of quality is mentioned only at the very end, and with about as much sincerity and emphasis as toy commercials tack on the phrase, each sold separately. There's no doubt about it, folks. Good and Evil was a terrible show. And if it got low ratings and deserved them, how does that damn the rating system? Northern Exposure is daring and different, and it's a top 20 hit. Twin Peaks was daring, but its ratings kept dropping, even though its quality didn't. The problem is that TV executives use ratings not as a measurement tool, but as a final judge. And that, by programming in search of the largest possible ratings, TV producers and networks often underestimate the intelligence and taste of the audience. Here's the most reprehensible remark in the whole program, courtesy of a TV research expert.
But I believe that success in television is the absence of negatives, far more than it is the delivery of just wildly positive pluses. I'm talking about when you do actually generate discomfort, strong negatives. I can't relate to that. That's not a situation where people would behave that way. Well, you create negatives, you are creating a problem for yourself.
If the major networks buy that line of logic, they won't be major networks much longer. The key to maintaining audience is to make the best possible shows, something that on this particular occasion, Nova failed to do.
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post. Coming up next, finding fast foods that are healthy. This is Fresh Air. Healthy fast food is not an oxymoron anymore. Oh, sure, if you chow down a bacon cheeseburger, fries, and a shake, you're not doing yourself any favors. But go for a lean hamburger or grilled chicken, a salad, and low-fat milk, and you could say you've eaten a relatively healthy meal. Michael Jacobson and the Center for Science in the Public Interest have been crusading to bring greater health consciousness to the fast food industry, and they say they're having some success. The worst fast food offenders still use enormous amounts of fat, salt, and sugar. But many fast food franchises have now switched from beef fat to vegetable shortening and have reduced the salt content in their meals. Michael Jacobson has just updated his fast food guide with new information about ingredients and nutrition. When we spoke, we started with the breakfast menu.
Breakfast used to be the hardest meal to get at a fast food restaurant if you wanted something nutritious. Typically, it would be like at McDonald's, a biscuit with sausage and egg. A lot of fat, a lot of cholesterol, a lot of salt. McDonald's now has probably the best breakfast in the fast food world. Cheerios, 1% low-fat milk, fat-free bran muffin, orange juice. That kind of a breakfast has less than 1 teaspoon of fat. Really remarkably good. For lunch or dinner, some chains have salads. Wendy's probably has the best salad bar in the business. Baked potatoes. You can get the low-fat hamburger at McDonald's. And all of these foods are pretty good unless you glop them up with a lot of sour cream, butter, cheese, adding loads of fat, loads of salt. So there are some decent items. Most of the foods, though, are still fried potatoes, fried chicken, greasy hamburger sandwiches, pizza with lots of cheese on it. And that won't do your waistline or your heart any good.
So if someone literally wanted to eat at fast food franchises 3 meals a day, 365 days a year, but made some healthy choices, would they be getting all the vitamins and minerals that they needed?
No, they probably wouldn't. And the thing that's hardest to get is dietary fiber. You get fiber from beans, from vegetables, from fruit, whole grains. And those are generally hard to find at a fast food restaurant. You will not find whole wheat buns at any of the chains. You can get vegetables if you really search for them. Fruit is totally unavailable except for occasional salad bars. But if you were forced to do that, and of course it's every kid's dream, of course, to eat every meal of the day, every day of the year at a fast food restaurant, if you're really smart, worked at it, you could get some decent meals.
What chain would you say has made the most dramatic changes?
I think McDonald's has, in terms of adding more healthful foods. They cut about 80% of the fat out of their milkshakes. They offer 1% low-fat milk, whereas virtually all the other chains offer 2% or whole milk. Fat-free bran muffins, a cold cereal that's a whole grain cereal. The McLean Deluxe hamburger, that has about half the fat of any other hamburger. So I'd give them very good grades. And they also have not had huge double hamburger sandwiches, although from time to time they offer double quarter pounders as a kind of a special item. So I'd give McDonald's, which is the biggest chain, the best grade for improvements.
You say that the McLean Deluxe is the healthiest hamburger around. What's the worst offender?
Well, the worst offenders are the double cheeseburgers. At Burger King, you could get a double Whopper with cheese. That has 14 teaspoons of fat, if you can believe that. That's about as much fat as an adult should have in an entire day. There's a West Coast chain, Carl's Jr., that has a double Western bacon cheeseburger. Mm. It has over 1,000 calories. Another West Coast chain. You know, you think, the West Coast, aren't they interested in health? Jack in the Box's Ultimate Cheeseburger, 16 teaspoons of fat. It's the fattiest food out there in the fast food world.
Michael Jacobson is my guest today, and he's the executive director of the Center for Science in the Public Interest. And we're talking about his fast food guide, which has just been completely revised and updated. Let's talk a little bit about salad bars, which have made an appearance in the last couple of years. Are people going to fast food restaurants and chowing down at the salad bar?
Well, salads and salad bars have been relatively profitable for the companies. and partly because their prices are for the salads are so high. In McDonald's and Burger King, a salad is more expensive than a double cheeseburger. So there's a they have a healthy profit margin in there. There are a lot of people like salads. They can be low in calories, very nutritious. Sometimes parents will bring kids to a fast food restaurant. The kids get hamburgers and fries. Parents will get a salad, salad dressing. And the basic salads are generally good. Chef salads tend to be higher in fat. Taco salads tend to be very high in fat. But a garden salad or a grill or a chunky chicken salad are quite good. The problems usually come in when you're getting the dressing. At Wendy's, for instance, there's a Caesar dressing, comes in a little packet, 320 calories, 9 teaspoons of fat. So you can ruin a salad. You can also add a lot of cheese, bacon bits, some of the other high-fat items to the salad, and essentially reduce its nutritional value by adding all that fat. But at McDonald's, there's a low-calorie vinaigrette dressing that has only 48 calories. Add that to a chunky chicken salad, you're about 200 calories, and it's terrific.
Is there a reason that Kentucky Fried Chicken is now known as KFC and that the word fried, they've determined, is a bad word?
Yeah, fried is a bad word. It gives them a bad name. Everybody in America now seems to be turning towards more healthy diets, and one way to cut out the fat and the calories is not to have fried foods. So KFC said, let's get rid of the fried from our name. They unfortunately did not get rid of the frying from any of their foods. And KFC is one of the hardest places to get a decent meal. Unlike Burger King, McDonald's, and Wendy's, you cannot get an unfried chicken sandwich or chicken salad. Everything is fried there. And so you end up with a lot of breading or batter and grease and chicken skin. You can, if you have the willpower, throw away the chicken skin and the breading, and you've knocked the calorie content in about half. You've gotten rid of two-thirds or three-fourths of the fat, and the chicken underneath is perfectly fine. But one of these days, KFC will learn how to make a grilled chicken sandwich.
Don't they have a fried chicken, though, that's breaded without the skin?
Well, it's been on and off. They've had a skinless fried chicken, and then they dropped it, and now they're going to come back with it. But there is still so much breading on the chicken that it's still high in fat.
Is this stuff selling? How is Kentucky Fried Chicken doing?
KFC is having a little harder time than some of the other chains, but there are thousands of outlets and people are buying an enormous amount of food. KFC still sells about $6 billion worth of food every year. They run through 500 million chickens a year. So they still have a few customers, but frankly, I think they'd have more customers if they offered a grilled chicken sandwich or some other kind of low-fat chicken item. Right now, the best you can do at KFC is to get any of the chickens and throw away the breading and the skin, get corn on the cob, mashed potatoes, baked beans at some of the restaurants. You could even be vegetarian at KFC.
Well, I often think that the fast food industry is a very easy target, and I think there's no question that they've served a lot of food that are high in fats and sodium and salt and sugar. But what evidence, I wonder, is if people actually are eating well at home, whether when left to their own devices, they're making a nice salad and baking their fish and having fresh fruit for dessert. I don't know whether you've even looked into that.
Well, when you look at the food served at fast food restaurants, they're not all that different from the kind of foods people are eating at home. People certainly do drink soda pop at home and beer. They do fry foods at home. They buy frozen meals that are loaded with fat and sodium. But Americans generally are switching to more healthful diets at home or at restaurants. Fresh fruit, fresh vegetable sales are up. Sales of whole wheat bread are up, brown rice, yogurt, and you see a proliferation of foods like the brand name Healthy Choices. Campbell has foods called Healthy Request that are a little lower in sodium and calories. So you know, we're going to be eating more nutritious foods. And many of the things that I've said concerning fast food restaurants also apply to packaged food companies, that many companies refuse to disclose information, but because of a new law, they'll be giving more information. They're trying to cut down on the sodium content, the fat content to their foods, because they see that's where America's going. We're a more sedentary society, a more health-conscious society. We have to get more vitamins and minerals in fewer calories. And the companies that don't switch, I think, are going to be left out in the cold.
Now, do you eat a fair amount of fast food?
Well, in writing this book, between me and my dog Howard, we ate a fair amount of this food. He was kind of the cleanup crew. But I tasted a lot of the foods, and I do, when I'm out traveling especially, sometimes stop in at a fast food restaurant, partly because I want to see what they're offering, and part for professional reasons, and partly because there's no other place to eat. And it's a pleasure to be able to get a wonderful salad or a baked potato at some of the restaurants.
So this is research you were doing then?
Absolutely. Yeah. Kind of when I was winding up the research on the book, I really did. I'd hit 6 fast food restaurants in a day. And, you know, probably 10-year-old boys would think this is the most wonderful job in the world to write a book about fast foods. But it gets a little torturous, nibbling away at dozens of these foods. And you kind of walk away from these restaurants feeling that everything... Yeah, it has the smell of grease and the taste of salt, and just not that appetizing.
Michael Jacobson is director of the Center for Science in the Public Interest. His fast food guide has just been updated. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up. Linda Wertheimer is in New Hampshire and joins us today to tell us about the show. Hi, Linda.
Hi, Marty. They're voting in New Hampshire today, of course. We'll have an interview asking why New Hampshire should go first, and a piece on New Hampshire's economy, about a supermarket in a little town closing, leaving not just a missing business, but something of a hole in the heart of the town as well. Michael Scholer will have more on hearings into the safety of breast implants. Michael Schuster from the Soviet Union on the meeting between Secretary of State Baker and President Yeltsin. And an interview with the managing editor of the Portland Oregonian on the newspaper's new policy of naming sports teams.
Thanks, Linda. Those stories and more later today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. It's been a couple of months since David Cronenberg's movie Naked Lunch opened. The movie's about the life and writings of William Burroughs, but it's taken until now for the soundtrack album to come out. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says he likes the music as much as he liked the movie.
That's Ornette Coleman on the soundtrack album to Naked Lunch. You might have read good things about the movie, which is a great mix of literary biography and junky science fiction, but reviewers haven't said enough about the music. The score, by Howard Shore, may make better use of a jazz soloist than any film since 1965's Mickey 1, which had Stan Getz blowing on Eddie Sauter charts. The Naked Lunch music follows a similar plan. Put a great saxophonist in front of a loose orchestral backdrop and let him go. Coleman's pleading sound and the way he works so many variations on a few basic materials, mostly his own favorite licks and one or two of Charlie Parker's, matches David Cronenberg's twitching variations on twisted images. Ornette's kind of crackpot bebop fits the movie's hallucinated version of 50s boho New York. This is the way jazz then would sound to folks who shoot up bug powder. Howard Shore picked Ornette Coleman as a soloist because of the film's setting, which drifts between claustrophobic New York and a claustrophobic vision of North Africa. Ornette came up listening to Charlie Parker's alto playing, and he's recorded with Jajouka musicians in Morocco. He slips between worlds the way Peter Weller's Bill Lee does in the film. The Naked Lunch soundtrack includes Ornette Coleman's first trio recordings in 25 years. It's his first record of any kind in almost four. Howard Shore says Coleman set out to play his version of Charlie Parker here, but he still sounds just like Ornette. He's got an excellent rhythm section, too. Barr Phillips on bass, and son and alter ego Denardo Coleman on drums. For contractual reasons and over Howard Shore's protests, Ornette Coleman gets no mention in the movie's opening credits, even though he plays behind them. Happily, the CD's credits are equitable. Even allowing for the filler and redundancy you find on any soundtrack album, and a few tracks Ornette doesn't play on, you can think of Naked Lunch as the new Ornette Coleman record. A really good Ornette Coleman record.
Kevin Whitehead is a freelance writer based in New York City. He reviewed the soundtrack album from Naked Lunch on the Milan label. Fresh Air is produced by Danny Miller, Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Joan Tuohy, and Sue Spolin. Research assistance from Ellen Silva. Our technical director is Audrey Fablitis. I'm Marty Moscowane.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next edition of Fresh Air, Edward Villela talks with us about his long career as a dancer and choreographer and his long relationship with choreographer George Balanchine. I hope you can join us.